Hello and welcome to a new episode of the New Books in Gender Studies podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Kyle McMillan, and today I have the pleasure of talking to Kinneret Lahad, professor at Tel Aviv University, talking about her new book, A Table for One, A Critical Reading of Singlehood, Gender, and Time. Professor, how are you doing today?
I'm feeling good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. So just to get started, why don't you give the listeners sort of a background into your academic career and sort of how you ended up talking about singlehood in your newest book?
Okay. Well, I'm a sociologist and a cultural studies and a feminist studies, gender studies scholar. And I think what sparked my interest in singlehood was my fascination with the ideal of the family, of the good family, of the happy family. And I began reading some critical feminist work on family, you know, stuff we have read in the 70s, the 80s, and also contemporary literature on the ideal of the family and the effect it has. And the more I understood the centrality of the ideology of the family and couplehood culture, I realized that I want to write about singlehood, about social phenomena that seemingly does not live up to this ideal, and what kind of effect does this ideal of the family have on singlehood and also on our perceptions of the good life, of the happy life, of the worthy life?
Yeah, and I found your book very interesting, and you focus mostly on single women. So why are people so concerned about single women, and what kind of women?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Well, first of all, of course, singlehood is a gendered phenomenon. I would love to write a book one day about single men. I think also single men are also subjected to stigmas and stereotypes, but the timetables and the schedules are different. It's not that it's only single women who are subjected to this kind of very critical patriarchal gaze. Men as well are subjected to a different kind of gaze, which evaluates them according to their achievements as men, as potential providers and fathers. So I don't remember the other half of your question. I remember the single woman.
Yeah, so why are people so concerned with single women, and then what kind of women in particular did you focus on?
Yeah. Well, that's a huge question. I'm not sure I have all the answers. And my book was an attempt to try and answer what gives this fear, fascination, contempt, patronizing attitude so much discursive force. And there are various sorts of answers. And instead of taking the shorter route, which is to say basically, yes, we live in a very couple-oriented, very patriarchal culture, very heteronormative culture, which believes that women can only be worthy and live meaningful lives if they are if they are taking care of a man, if they are taking care of children, if they are evaluated by men, and etc. So this is, I think, something that we already acknowledge. And I wanted to understand what gives these assumptions contemporary discursive power. And I realized it was that one of the answers would be the notion of time, understanding how temporal models and temporal concepts constitute women's subjectivities and life trajectories. And this was the big project of my book, actually, contributing to more, to singlehood is still an understudied and under-theorized field of research. Definitely, if we compare this to sociology of family and personal relationships, it's still very much under-theorized. And my book, in that respect, attempted to contribute to the theory and to provide more answers to this question. My book, in particular, focused on middle, upper, mostly white women. And we can definitely say that that popular culture and media culture are very much fascinated by this demographic group. Also because they're perceived to be, and I'm putting this in quote, good, reproductive material, which is wasted if it's not materialized and through a man and having children. But I think here lies so much potential for further studies on singlehood, because singlehood is an intersectional phenomenon and an intersectional experience. And there is still so much to be done in relation to how singlehood intersects with race, with sexual orientation, with women who are disabled or have various kinds of disabilities. It differs greatly according to geographical locations. If you are single in the city or outside of the city, it makes a huge difference. So shortly, there are so many things to explore. And my book is in that respect an invitation to expand this field of studies, which I think has so much potential.
No, I would agree. And I really found the work that you did with singlehood and time to be very, it was something that I had never thought about. So it was kind of a new avenue for me to explore as well. So I know that you spend sort of, good portions of the book going through different examples of this, so you don't have to be exhaustive, but I think it's useful to start out with, what does time have to do with being single? What are some things that you found out regarding the relationship between the two?
Well, this was a fascinating investigation, because as it occurs in many researchers, in many, fields of investigation, time found me. That was not my initial intention. I thought to write at the beginning about singlehood and social emotions, about singlehood and shame and happiness and jealousy and, all these, expand our knowledge on the on how emotions are socially constructed in relation to singlehood. But as I was exploring the text I was analyzing, time, the notion of time, timing, different concepts which refer to time, such as waiting, wasting time, time out, when, still, kept appearing from the data, and I understood that time and how time is perceived is one of the main avenues in which singleism, what Bella DiPaolo refers to as stigmas and stereotypes against single people, is exercised and reinforced. Because we tend to think about these concepts as very much normative, naturalized, and varying qualities of truth. One cannot argue with time. One cannot argue with age. One cannot argue with, the life course. We have so many models and collective clocks and collective rhythms and collective timetables, which we perceive to be something that cannot be contested. And I said, no, I want to contest these concepts which we use and take for granted. So this was my project, to try and deconstruct these notions and understand how time is socially constructed, how time is a social achievement. It is based on social agreement. And here I found the literature, the sociological, and also feminist and queer literature on time to be absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah, and, you know, I thought that was a very interesting and poignant, you know, social construction to really tangle with, especially when we talk about, you know, social relationships or, you know, in the case of singlehood, sort of a perceived lack of that relationship. So you mentioned that you sort of used aspects of popular culture or just culture writ large to find your data. So what parts of the culture did you analyze, and what did they tell? What did those data points tell you about singlehood?
Yeah, well, it was, I admit, it was a big surprise. I was surprised along the way. Because I found that mainstream popular culture tends to be very conservative and lacks any alternative imagination in relation to singlehood and gendered life scripts in general. To a very large extent, it is still very conservative and heteronormative. So part of my analysis, in order to understand how social temporal norms are endorsed, used popular culture, which I refer here to movies, to television series, to songs, to cliches, etc. For example, in I think it's chapter 7 in my book, I analyze two very classical songs, one called The Man I Love, performed by various performers, and the other one is Eleanor Rigby. And through the analysis of these songs, I demonstrate how waiting and singlehood are relational, and one should understand how waiting functions here and creates hierarchies of relations between single and non-single, and how the perception of waiting is a gendered one in which women are perceived to be waiting for the one until a particular point in their life in which they are not waiting anymore. And through this, I developed the whole idea of the queue, of who can stand in line and who cannot stand in line anymore. And these, of course, are not neutral assumptions. They are socially laden and very much dependent on one's age and one's market worth in the dating game and in the marriage market. So this is just one of the examples how I use the text. And most of the alternative perceptions, most of the alternative temporal perceptions of singlehood, I found in a couple of sites, usually the internet and the blogs, where today I think it's the most potent sources for alternative articulations of women's subjectivities, and also quite surprisingly, self-help books. Which there is a genre of self-help books which actually provides women with alternative ways to imagine their lives. I've written many years ago a paper about it in Hebrew, and also a colleague of mine, Anita Taylor from the University of Sydney, writes about self-help books for women in her papers and in her books. And that was really a wonderful surprise. I really didn't expect that.
Yeah, and you talked earlier about sort of the power of discourse here as well. So I thought one of the interesting ideas that you brought up in your book is this idea of discourse leading to one becoming single. So how does one become single as a discursive process?
Yeah, that is something that I was very much intrigued with by myself, because as opposed to the quite scripted patterns in which we become married or become parents or even become couples, there is no clear and institutionalized and script way to become a single. No one wishes you to be single when you are young, and then no one at a point in your life gives you a certificate, or you don't have a ritual which marks you entering the singlehood life. And by using Erwin Goffman's concept of the career, I try to conceptualize and think about singlehood as about the singlehood career, as which in many ways offers us a different and a very much subtle way in which one becomes single, and a particular kind of single. The irony, of course, is that we are all born single. We're not born coupled and married. And of course, we become single when we are expected to be married. And this, you know, becomes your, and as more and more people in your peer group get coupled or married or have children, then you gradually become single, and singlehood becomes your master status, something which becomes one of your prime markers of who you are and your identity and how you present yourself and how you are perceived and evaluated. And then, you know, I show this in the second chapter of my book, that there are these years in which I view as, you know, the difficult years, the years in which single women are constantly pressured and asked and evaluated and bid to get married soon or bid to find your right one. The sooner the better, and they should learn how to compromise. And then comes the point in which there are just all this calms down and the pressure is comes non-existent. And then many becoming single is becoming a stable identity, and yet still is very much subjected to all kinds of stories. What happened? How did she miss the train? It is such a pity. She used to be so beautiful. It's such a pity. She's so successful. All she's missing is, of course, three points. But it's a fascinating social process to understand that one becomes single through the social scripts of marriage and couplehood.
Yeah, and I thought it was really interesting too. You talk sort of midway through your book about sort of how women transition from the category of young single woman to woman past her prime, essentially. So, yeah. Is this transition period clear or more muddled, and why is that?
You know, it's interesting. During the years I've been researching singlehood, often people have asked me, so can you give me an age in which one turns from a very promising young single to a desperate single woman? And of course, I could never give the answer the different audiences demanded from me, because of course, this age group can be very different from culture to culture. For example, even in Israeli society, there are huge differences between secular Jewish women to religious women and ultra-Orthodox women. So the expectations from one to get married and the phase in which one becomes an old maid, of course, I put this in quotes, are of course, very much dependent on the social context which one lives in. So there is no specific age, but at the same time, there is the understanding that emerges from the attitudes towards youth, that it emerged again and again from the various texts I've analyzed, in which women say, "Yeah, I think I won't attend family dinners anymore, or I'm not going to attend my best friend's wedding, and because all these occasions turn into settings in which the pressure is unbearable." So I think in many ways this turning point is very much structured by the social gaze, which constantly evaluates what is the social worth and what is the market value of women. And this is really one of the, I think it's in chapter 5, is a particularly difficult, and I'm saying difficult in, I think, emotionally. For me, emotionally, it was a very difficult chapter to write, because it was the way the language of the market is connected to the language of patriarchy and sexism and ageism is just unbearable. How women are evaluated according to their age, their ability to attract the right man, and not missing, of course, the right reproductive moment. And of course, the sad thing is the extent to which so many women and so many men internalize this logic. And this is not something that is often not talked about. It's out there in the open, and anyone who looks into dating apps and dating sites can see how this logic informs our evaluation are as relevant as ever.
Yeah, I thought that was particularly interesting how you went into sort of how single women are commodified. And I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, there's actually a book written by an economist that is titled something to the effect of "Everything You Want to Know About Economics, You'll Learn Through Tinder" or something like that. So yeah, it's definitely a theme that runs throughout, and I think you really captured that well. I think that leads to one of my other questions, though. You kind of talk about in the book how singlehood needs to be, in your view, sort of this other lens of identity where that might lead to discrimination. So I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about that and sort of how you arrived at that conclusion.
Yeah, sure. I think it's after I've read Susan Orbach's book, Why Fatness is a Feminist Issue, I realized more and more that singlehood should be a feminist issue and should be analyzed as such, as feminist, and singlehood is also a political issue, which is connected to relations of power, which is related to forms of discrimination, which is related to symbolic violence and issues of social justice. Now, this form of discrimination is often not very visible. It's often very subtle. I can give you an example from the Israeli housing market, in which most houses are built for families. And it's very difficult for single men and women to find two-bedroom apartments. Now, of course, the housing market is a catastrophe, as it is for everyone. And if I would, and I do participate in these kind of demonstrations, I think that people who are, it's not, you know, the first demonstration I would go out on the street for. There are so many ways in which people are discriminated through, you know, neoliberal ideologies. But this is just a manifestation that shows how single men and women are discriminated in terms of where they can live and the possibility to afford their way of living. And when singlehood is also connected to other parameters such as class and race and ethnicity, so a single woman's possibility for economical autonomy, it becomes very, very difficult. Living in a pair, living as a couple, is definitely more affordable. And I can say that about Israel, but definitely reading research from elsewhere, this point is very much relevant to many, Anglo-American cultures as well. So this is just one example, but there are many more. Scholars like Bella Di Paolo have written a lot about discrimination in the workforce, about how single persons are often expected to work more hours. They are very much taken for granted. They are expected not to take vacations at times which are suitable for them, because the family-oriented vacation is valued more. There are, of course, many many forms of discrimination which are related to tax deduction. In the U.S., the issue of health benefits is crucial. If you can get your health benefits, better health benefits, through your partner. So there are many, many forms of discrimination which singlehood scholars point their fingers on and things that should be changed. The other aspect is, of course, the symbolic one and the violent one in terms of how single people are perceived to be less happy, less respectful, less trustful, living in the shadow of the centrality of the couple and family form of life. And I hope that in that respect, my work is very political, because I attempt to change these perceptions and uncover how these are socially related. And of course, I'm not saying that singlehood is better than couplehood, or being child-free better than being a parent. Not at all. I'm just offering, in that sense, to look at singlehood as another option for living, which is not necessarily better or worse. It's just another option that could be there, and not, you know, a mere, you know, the end of the world as it is usually portrayed.
Yeah, and I think you do a really, really fine job of sort of describing how both socially and legally there are these aspects that you mentioned that sort of discriminate or cause sort of discriminatory outcomes for single people. So I thought that was a really important point. So this question goes back to the power of discourse, but you kind of bring it up later in your book. But how does discourse contribute to women, you know, quote unquote, aging faster, sort of accelerating the aging process?
Yeah, that is really one part of the book which I really love. And it's the notion and the perception of single women as aging faster than the married and coupled one actually emerged from a question I raised, in which I asked myself, how come women who can be at the same age group. Let's take, for example, a single woman who is 30 and a married woman who is 30. Let's say an Israeli secular society. And one could be depicted as an old maid or as soon to be an old maid. And the other one is presented to be a young bride or a young mom. And here I understood that the symbolic way in which we age, not the chronological age, but the symbolic, the social age, can lead me to understanding what gives the notion of the old maid so much discursive force and so much discursive power, and why is being tagged as an old maid still perceived to be such a terrible and humiliating stigma bestowed upon a single woman. And then reading through studies about ageism, which means the discrimination of people according to their age, and the intersection of ageism and sexism and singleism, has led me to understand that because single women do not live up to the age expectation, and because single women, and that's of course my interpretation, there could be so many in that respect, but because single women are evaluated through their age, in which age becomes a master status, their time is perceived to be more limited, and therefore they're especially in this kind of very stressful time period, and this is one of the reasons I propose that they undergo accelerated aging. And this also corresponds to studies conducted by scholars exploring masculinity and homosexuals and ballet dancers and athletes, which have shown, and also a beautiful study on table dancers, which have shown that people's end of career as a ballet dancer, for example, her career can end sooner as a ballet dancer. So in some way, this logic is also employed upon a single woman as well. And I found this absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting how, you know, usually we think of the aging process as this biological process. We don't really consider it as something that is socially constructed as well. So I thought that was a really important point. So you talk about how much work goes into sort of keeping up the appearance of being a single woman. So what does that work look like? And how is time significant for that work?
Yes. Writing that chapter is heavily indebted to the work of Erwin Goffman. I realized by analyzing the text that many women find public settings as weddings, as dinners, as dinner at work-related functions, all kinds of rituals, New Year's Eve, Valentine's Day, to be quite traumatic and to be a potential time and place in which singlehood becomes hyper-visible, and also a time and place in which singlehood becomes could be a potential source of embarrassment and humiliation. And we have various representations of these dynamics, for example, in Sex and the City, in Friends, and in many of the texts I've analyzed. And I wanted to understand why. What happens in these particular times in which single women are so put so much effort and thought of avoiding these interactions in these particular times. So one of the first things that was quite apparent that occasions such as the weekends or Valentine's Day or New Year's Eve are, of course, related to be very heteronormative ones, in which heteronormativity is the expectation and the norm. And then your singlehood is not something that you can hide. You cannot, it is quite clear that if you arrive to a Valentine's Day or a New Year's Eve celebration on your own, that your single status, at, of course, at a particular point in your life, is very visible. And it, many single women feel very much exposed at these points in their time. And by using Goffman, I contend in this chapter that while appearing in the couple unit, you are granted with civil inattention. The fact that no one pays any particular attention to you, like when we cross one another in the streets and not bump into another or sit next to or sit in the bus with this courtesy that Goffman refers to as civil inattention. I acknowledge that you are here, but I'm not giving any particular attention to the fact that you're here. And when in these very heteronormative moments, single women experience what I term is uncivil attention, following the work the disability scholar Barlow Thompson, in which their singlehood becomes hyper visible. And thus so much effort and so many attempts are directed to avoid or even renting a boyfriend. Of course, these are, of course, all these Hollywood films which deal with these issues. And more seriously, trying to cover up and appear in not in a single unit, but in a couple unit. And time here plays a crucial role because you can hide behind a book in Starbucks in the afternoon. And after living in New York, I think it was last year, so you can also get away with Starbucks, I think on Saturday night as well. But going to a fancy restaurant or even not a fancy restaurant or going to Valentine's Day on your own, you cannot hide between anything. And these are moments in which women feel very much exposed and that they lack any control on how society perceives them.
Right. And I think, you know, that's a very interesting point because, you know, that kind of also ties back into sort of the commodification of single women, right? Sort of this aspect of labor, you know, that goes into keeping up these appearances. So this question sort of harkens back to your second chapter, but I thought it was important to sort of lay the groundwork of your argument before asking it. But in chapter two, this is a direct quote from your book, but you say, "The refusal to abide by these temporal schemes could potentially contaminate gender relations between men and women." So you already talked about sort of how the notion of singlehood sort of upholds the patriarchy, but sort of what are you envisioning, you know, as the result if we really sort of dig into what it means to be single and sort of parse out the social meanings? What could be this sort of contamination that you're talking about?
That's really a good question, which I admit I have to think further about it after we finish talking. And I think in so many ways, being single is a refusal to take upon oneself the roles women are expected to take. And this includes the reproductive roles, the physical roles, the emotional labor kind of tasks women have to take upon themselves when they enter the couple and family unit. And in many respects, this is why singlehood presents and could be figured as a danger, as something which is not understood, which is scary. And in so many ways, this is one of my explanations in which I think that today there is a backlash, which is, of course, it has many manifestations. We can now understand this backlash in so many arenas in which gender relations are contested. But despite the growing rates of single women worldwide, and despite the fact that we have, if we look deeper into into various kinds of social ways of living, we do have alternatives to the marriage and the parent kinds of living, but still the possibility of ending up as an old maid sounds like the phantom, sounds like the worst thing that can possibly happen to women. No one wishes you to end up as a single. You are constantly bid to get married soon and that everything will be wonderful when you get married. So in many ways, and sometimes it's very sophisticated ways and sometimes it's very violent and direct ones, there is this backlash which is very much threatened by this independence, by this economical and emotional autonomy of women. Let's say, for example, some of them say we are better off alone, and some of them say I refuse to compromise, and others say all kinds. They in so many ways, they refuse the centrality of men and having a monogamous relationship, a long-term relationship in their lives. And this very much destabilizes many belief systems. And this is also one of my explanations for the backlash in which we are constantly enduring in so many places, not only in the U.S. and Israel.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, that sort of thinking or theorizing about how to disrupt sort of these power structures is at least something that I took away from that portion of your book. And I know that we've taken up a lot of your time today, so I just have a couple more questions. If you were to have people that listen to this podcast or read your book take away sort of one key thing, what would that key thing, in your opinion, be?
It's going to sound a bit like a self-help book, but I'm going to try anyway, because there are so many self-help books, which I really admire their political strength. I think that the stereotypes against single men and women are so violent and are so discriminatory and so humiliating. It is still perfectly fine to ask someone to account for the single status and explain how come they are single for so many years and explain what went wrong, etc., etc. If people who are reading my book could rethink about the violence that sometimes they inflict upon themselves and inflict upon others using these unquestioned temporal models and assumptions, if this book could give more avenues for imagining oneself as an adult or as a young adult or someone in their 50s and 60s, and not, you know, not bracketed or articulated according to the terms of I'm single by choice or I'm not single by choice, I'm happily single or not happily single, but just as another form of living which could have various benefits and disadvantages along the way and could be just as complicated as couples and the parent kind of life, and get rid of this kind of hierarchical belief system, then the political objective of my book hopefully will help, you know, is to help destabilize this hierarchical belief system. That was my objective in conducting my research and also conducting my current research, is trying to destabilize that primacy and the centrality of the nuclear monogamous family ideal in which we still cling to no matter how much it disappoints us and can disillude us throughout our lives.
No, I think that's an excellent takeaway. And my final question is, if you were to recommend a few books to people that either found this interview interesting or found your book very interesting, what would you recommend their next step would be?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Thank you so much. Well, first of all, my gratitude, and I'm not the only one who's grateful for Bella De Paolo's books and activism. She has, she constantly writes on her blog. She's interviewed for so many papers and important forums, and she is one of the scholars which I think, in particular, her book "Single Out" could be a wonderful book to start with. Another book which I love is written by Anita Taylor. It's called "Single Women in Popular Culture." It was published by Palgrave in 2012. Another wonderful book is by Jill Reynolds, published in 2008, called "The Single Woman: A Discursive Investigation." And another very interesting book and very insightful book is by Trimberger Ellen Kay. It's called "The New Single Woman." And two books which have garnered quite a lot of media attention in the last years. One of them is Eric Kleinenberg's book, which entitled "Going Solo," and also Michael Cope's book called "Single Arguments for the Uncoupled," which also includes some more queer theory inspired arguments. And surprisingly, despite all this wonderful scholarship, it is still very much understudied in academia. There is still so much wonderful work to be done and conducted. So I invite the readers and the listeners to explore this understudied field.
Yeah, and I will admit, it's something that has definitely piqued my interest as a researcher, so I'll probably have to check out some of those books as well. But Professor, I want to thank you again for joining us, and I want to implore people to go out and check out A Table for One, A Critical Reading of Singlehood, Gender, and Time. Professor, thank you for joining the New Books Network.
Thank you so much. And if I may, I will just stress that the book can be downloaded legally and for free in the link. So if you look for the link in an open access, it's a wonderful project called Knowledge Unlatched, which was generous to agree to fund the book for it to be open access.
Yeah,
so thank you so much.
Yeah, I think that's a great it is a great resource for people out there. So again, thank you for joining us. And, you know, the next time you decide to write a book, another book, you know, we'll invite you back on.
Wonderful. Thank you so much and take care. Thank you.